your host, Lawson Hunter. Earth Matters examines the impacts we have on the environment and reports on solutions and alternatives that help protect and preserve a healthy planet. And, I might add, stories that give us hope. One such story is the news item about a 15-year-old student living in Stockholm, Sweden. Since August, every Friday, Greta Thunberg has skipped her school classes to sit outside her country's parliament. She has vowed to continue to do so until leaders in Sweden come into line with the Paris Agreement. Greta writes, "I first learned about climate change when I was 8 years old. I learned that this was something humans had created. I was told to turn off the lights to save energy and recycle paper to save resources. I remember thinking it was very strange that we were capable of changing the entire face of the Earth and the precious thin layer of atmosphere that makes it our home. And yet, our leaders weren't even talking about it. If burning fossil fuels threatens our very existence, then how could we continue to burn them? Why were there no restrictions? Why wasn't it illegal to do this? Why wasn't anyone talking about the dangerous climate change we have already locked in? And what about the fact that up to 200 species are going extinct every single day? We can no longer save the world by playing by the rules because the rules have to be changed. Countries like Sweden need to start reducing our emissions by at least 15% every year if we consider the aspect of equality or climate justice, a principle that is clearly stated everywhere in the Paris Agreement. And that is just so we can stay below 2 degrees, which we now know will still create misery for so many people and ecosystems around the world. The adults have failed us, and since most of them, including the press and the politicians, keep ignoring the situation, we must take action into our own hands, starting today." Greta's actions also influenced students around the world. Thousands of school children across Australia walked out of class in late November to demand action by their federal government on climate change. The Strike for Climate Action, inspired by 15-year-old Swedish student Greta Thunberg, brought together children in capital cities and 20 regional centers throughout Australia. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, had urged students not to take part and told them to be, quote, less activist. The Resources Minister for Australia, Matt Canavan, said he would prefer students to learn about mining and science. Quote, "These are the type of things that excite young children, and we should be great at it as a nation." He went on, "The best thing you'll learn about going to a protest is how to join the dole queue." Kelsey Juliana and 20 other young Americans are suing the U.S. government, alleging that the U.S. government is violating their constitutional rights and threatening their futures by perpetuating the nation's fossil fuel energy system and knowingly causing climate change for over 50 years. Young people in Colombia have already tasted victory in a similar dispute with their government, which started in early 2017. In April, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of 25 plaintiffs, ranging in age from 7 to 26, and ordered the government to stop the deforestation of the Amazon rainforest. In Canada, Catherine Gauthier got sick of hearing Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's federal government make bold promises on climate change while spending $4.5 billion to purchase oil sands projects such as the Kinder Morgan pipeline. Gauthier is executive director of Environnement Jeunesse, an environmentally youth group based in Montreal. Recently, her group teamed up with the law firm of Trudell, Johnson & L'Espérance and applied to the Superior Court of Quebec to bring a class action lawsuit on behalf of all Quebec residents under the age of 35. The lawsuit alleges that the Canadian government is infringing on a generation's fundamental rights by failing to meet the climate targets Canada agreed to at the Paris Conference of the Parties 21. A recent UN report, for example, singled out Canada for being nowhere close to its goal of 385 million tons of carbon dioxide equivalent per year. In 2016, its emissions were nearly double that. Inspired by these and other actions, we present a clip from Greta Thunberg's address to the UN COP24 conference that recently concluded in Portugal.
For 25 years, countless of people have stood in front of the United Nations climate conferences, asking our nation's leaders to stop the emissions. But clearly, this has not worked since the emissions just continue to rise. So I will not ask them anything. Instead, I will ask the people around the world to realize that our political leaders have failed us. Because we are facing an existential threat, and there is no time to continue down this road of madness. Rich countries like Sweden need to start reducing emissions by at least 15% every year to stay below a 2-degree warming target. You would think the media and every one of our leaders would be talking about nothing else, but they never even mention it. Nor does hardly anyone ever mention that we are in the midst of the sixth mass extinction, with up to 200 species going extinct every single day. Furthermore, does no one ever speak about the aspect of equity, clearly stated in the Paris Agreement, which is absolutely necessary to make it work on a global scale. That means that rich countries, like mine, need to get down to zero emissions within 6 to 12 years with today's emission speed. Because how can we expect countries like India, Colombia or Nigeria to care about the climate crisis if we, who already have everything, don't care even a second about our actual commitments to the Paris Agreement? So when school started in August this year, I sat myself down on the ground outside of the Swedish Parliament. I school strike for the climate. Some people say that I should be in school instead. Some people say that I should study to become a climate scientist so that I can solve the climate crisis. But the climate crisis has already been solved. We already have all the facts and solutions. And why should I be studying for a future that soon may be no more, when no one is doing anything to save that future? And what is the point of learning facts when the most important facts clearly means nothing to our society? Today we use 100 million barrels of oil every single day. There are no politics to change that. There are no rules to keep that oil in the ground. So we can no longer save the world by playing by the rules, because the rules have to be changed. So we have not come here to beg the world leaders to care for our future. They have ignored us in the past and they will ignore us again. We have come here to let them know that change is coming, whether they like it or not. The people will rise to the challenge. And since our leaders are behaving like children, we will have to take the responsibility they should have taken long ago. Thank you.
Despite the doom and gloom we often hear, and the disasters and catastrophic events that grab headlines, there is an optimistic stream that flows through society when we hear of individuals, organizations, and increasingly businesses that refuse to let human-induced climate change take over. Continuing in our series of businesses that are fighting climate change, we join the folks at the Sustainable Hamilton Burlington Expo 2018.
So it's Kim Goot here, back again with Lawson Hunter. We're at the Sustainable Business Expo 2018. It's the first ever sustainable business trade show style event in the Bay Area. Part of the reason we threw the first ever Sustainable Business Expo was because we know a lot of environmental service providers and a lot of really innovative companies in Hamilton and Burlington. Some are our members, some are not. So this event was one way to get them all under the same roof and facilitate business-to-business connections. So no matter what company or organization you are, you can meet, you can make the connections that you need to achieve your sustainability vision. And of course, we're here facilitating introductions and making sure everybody leaves feeling inspired.
And overall, do you find that more companies and corporations are paying attention to sustainability?
I would say over the past 20 years, it has become very much the norm. It started really with the leaders, and now it's becoming more of a day-to-day thing. A lot of our original members were leaders in the community, and now we have other companies coming to us looking for help so that they can catch up, because there's a new generation of buyers and there's a new generation of employees that are values-based shoppers and values-based workers. And in order to get the best and the brightest, and in order to retain customer equity, you really have to appeal to their value system. There are major environmental and social problems in the world with climate change and growing income inequality. And more, the public is looking to businesses as solutions providers for the world's biggest problems. And I think the best example of the prevalence of sustainability is the rise of socially responsible investments. So now you have the major five banks, like your Scotiabank and your TD, offering impact funds, or they're offering what are called SRIs, socially responsible investments, where it used to be more boutique firms, or you would ask your financial advisor about it and they wouldn't know what you were talking about. So that's kind of the latest reiteration. And then, of course, our conversation today about blockchain being a driver for sustainability also shows that it's being accepted and used as a tool for the future.
I'm Stephanie McLarty. I'm the CEO of Reficient. Reficient is a reuse and recycling solution for businesses. So if you've got technology sitting around your business and you don't know what to do with it, you can come by and drop it off our location in Hamilton, and we'll reuse and recycle it, depending on what it is, and give sustainability reporting. I started the company in 2010, and we currently divert over 65,000 products every year from landfill through our reuse program. And we've primarily worked within the telecom sector as well as audio video sectors. But we've just expanded to this more general program because we've gotten so many calls and emails about what do I do with my old technology. And our goal is to divert it from landfill or even recycling if possible, if there's still some reuse potential in it.
So do you reuse the components? Do you fix them up if they're broken? Or is it basically breaking them down into the different parts, the different elements?
It's a great question. We first look at whether we can reuse the actual product itself. And depending on what it is, we will test and refurbish it. In other cases, we'll just sell it as is. If the product can't be reused, but there's a component within it that can, then we'll reuse that. For example, we get in lots of PVRs and set-top boxes, and often the actual set-top box has no reuse potential, but inside there could be a hard drive, and that hard drive might be reusable. So we'll take that out and recycle the rest. So it really depends on the products and what the situation is for it.
And do you have the people with the skills to do that, or do you outsource that?
We do a mixture of both. So we do some of it in-house and some of it we outsource. And it really depends on the type of technology. If it requires really specialized testing, then we will send it out. Otherwise, we try and do as much as we can internally here in Hamilton.
Now, you said that you received a lot of phone calls and emails from people hoping to expand your inventory. What has the response from the community been?
So from day one, we've had a tremendous response from the community. And I think it's because it really resonates with people that on a personal level, as you turn over your laptops and your cell phones, what do you do with the old ones? And you want to do the right thing with it, but maybe you don't know where to send it. So from the beginning, we've received a great response. We also certified as a B Corporation. So the B stands for benefit. So it means that we're for profit and for good. So we voluntarily commit to higher levels in terms of how we treat our employees, how we treat the environment, and what we do for the community. And so that has also resonated with people, that we're not just in this just for profit, that there really is a foundation, that this company is for good as well. And I'm really proud of that. We were Hamilton's first certified B Corp, and it's really a movement that has been growing that's really about redefining what success is in business. Yes, the bottom line is important, but it's more than that. It's about being a good company. And so that's something that we're proud of. We've been certified for several years now. And I think with all those things, the Hamilton community has really embraced us. And we're lucky that we have customers right across Canada and internationally as well. And so people get that, and they want to work with a company that does good.
So that brings up the question, if it's profitable, if it's in high demand, what about competition? Are you finding there are other companies doing the same thing?
Refishing does have lots of competition in certain areas of our business. So I mentioned we do a lot of work in the telecom sector. There are other companies out there that reuse and resell telecom equipment. So we have competition that way. In terms of the full suite of services of what we do, we don't have anyone head-to-head. And we also provide sustainability reporting. That aspect, too, we don't really have any competition with. So in some ways, we have lots of competition, and in other ways, not really direct competition either. So it's an interesting place to be.
Okay. And what about yourself? What got you involved in this? What's your background?
Well, I've been sustainability oriented for as long as I can remember. And how I got into this is that after I graduated from McMaster, I decided I wanted to take a couple years off and travel the world. And I did that. I spent 6 months in Thailand, a year in India. And then I started my master's in peace and conflict transformation in Austria. And at the time, I thought I would work for the UN. And because I started my master's after having traveled and I was essentially broke, I decided that I would come home and work for a bit and make some money and then go back and finish. And that's what I did. And the job I got was at Rogers. And so for about 8 months, I wore steel-toed boots and I drove around a red Rogers van and I went out to the network sites across Ontario and physically pulled out the old equipment and figured out what to do with it. So can it be reused internally? Could it be reused or sold to someone else, etc.? And by the end of my contract, I had this niche knowledge of telecom infrastructure equipment. Honestly, something I knew nothing about when I got started. And so I went back to school. I did finish. And I started consulting in this space. I consulted for a few years. And then I launched Refishent in 2010 as a technology-based solution. So we built a software platform that helps us to manage what companies have, what other companies need, and derive the sustainability data, such as waste diversion metrics, the estimated carbon footprint, and that kind of thing. So I would say that for me, because this has always been about a higher purpose, that this is about equipment staying out of landfill, and that this world and businesses specifically need solutions to help them to do good and to be efficient with resources, that has helped me. And particularly in the early days when it's really hard to get a business going, I'm so glad that I had that higher purpose, because I think at certain times I probably would have given up otherwise, given how hard it was.
Right.
But
if people want to find out more about Refishent, how can they contact you?
Well, the easiest thing is to go to our website, which is refishent.com, and that's the word efficient with an R on the front. So refishent.com.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
My name is Steve Hyman. I'm the president and founder of Green Planet Biofuels in Toronto. We locally collect spent cooking oil from restaurants and provide a grease interceptor service to those restaurants. Currently, we service close to 2,000 locations in southern Ontario. All the oil we collect is destined for the feedstock of biodiesel or our waste products going to anaerobic digestion in Elmira.
Okay. So 5 years ago, 10 years ago, people like Neil Young were going around gathering cooking oil from McDonald's.
I started in a very similar way. I was a chef actually at a golf course, and I had read somewhere, maybe it was from Neil Young's bus, that I could power my car on spent cooking oil. And I spent some time researching it. And initially, Green Planet kind of was a broader business. My original plan was to collect this oil, clean it, and convert commercial diesel trucks to run on straight vegetable oil. And quickly, I learned that was several businesses I was trying to start at the same time. And we essentially became a collector of used cooking oil. And you know, we spent the last 10 years kind of learning how to do it, and you know, starting from scratch. And today we collect, you know, between 70 and 100,000 liters a week of spent oil.
In the Golden Horseshoe, Toronto.
Yeah, like Southern Ontario. In the east, we go to kind of Bowmanville. In the west, we're going to Kitchener, Waterloo, and into Niagara. And we go all the way up to Orillia in the north.
Okay. Now, again, 10 years ago, it seemed to be cutthroat. People were stealing oil from different places. What's the landscape look like today?
It's similar to that. There's a lot of oil theft, and we do a lot to protect it. And a lot of that is actually just trying to get ahead of the thieves and get it before they can get it. But it's something we work on, and we work with our clients to try to prevent, you know, with cameras, and we try to move containment into areas that are less likely to get, you know, robbed.
So, in other words, it's a high revenue area, or has the potential.
Yeah, well, potentially, you know, the markets have been low, you know, in the last 6 or 8 months. But like all commodities, but I think that, you know, the future looks bright, and we're really focused, you know, on recycling and putting that spent oil into fuel as opposed to other things in the province. And and we focus heavily on, you know, the social responsibility, you know, aspect. Our guys, we do a lot of outreach with marginalized people in Toronto. We support charities that believe in the same. We offer, you know, above average wages to our employees. We provide them with health benefits. We even go so far as to getting our own trucks to run on the oil we're collecting. We convert a percentage to fuel.
Let's talk about how large the company is. How many employees do you have?
There's 11 people. Mm-hmm. Okay. 11 people. The company, we're servicing almost 2,000 individual locations. That's restaurants, shopping centers, commercial food manufacturers, you know, anybody with spent oil, we want to get in front of them.
Now, from a scientific point of view, what have you learned over the years about biofuels?
Oh, that's a big question, actually. I've learned that there's a lot more room to grow it in Ontario, and I think that the government could really make a push to get away from fossil fuel diesel, because I believe there's a lot of room for improvement in what we're doing, as well as with municipal transit. I think that the government could lead the way by getting their own fleets to run on renewable fuels as opposed to fossil fuels.
And if people want to get in touch or find out more about you or biofuels, how can they do that?
They can find us at greenplanetbf.com.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you. Okay.
Hey there, I'm Luke from Humble Bee. It's a local bee farm based out of Hamilton. And we're here connecting with people that want to support a local food business such as ours and help bees as well.
Okay. Why are bees important to you?
I've always had a fascination with bees and insects, I guess, in general and in nature. So our relationship with honeybees as humans goes back quite a long ways, and the fascination from learning more about bees is fairly endless. Every year I'm learning new things, and the bees surprise me all the time. So it always has my interest.
Okay. You have a farm yourself, but you also do some outreach. You talk to different people that might consider having a hive in their on their property. How does that work?
Yeah, so we do education outreach as well. We talk in schools, we talk with businesses, and we do lessons as well for people that are wanting to know what is involved in beekeeping or with bees in general. Some people are, on their way to getting beehives in their backyards, and maybe they're learning the process is a bit intense and they don't have time for it, so they would still like to do it, but would want to do it responsibly, which is when we can actually provide a hosted beehive for them, where they host a hive and we do all the work, the management, the paperwork, and the responsibility of looking after the bees, and they get honey out of their own backyard.
Where do you sell your products?
We have a few different locations around Hamilton. One of the more interesting locations is the Mustard Seed Co-op, where they have bees actually on their roof.
Oh, yeah.
And they sell the honey from those bees. So going into a grocery store and being able to buy honey that's produced there is extremely unique, and you really can't find much more local food than that.
So they have a great answer to the question, where did this honey come from?
Yeah, and they can point up. Yeah, so it's
great. So where do you get your funding from? How do you keep in business?
Wow, so we've been fairly successful with our business, and as farmers, I think have a skill out of necessity. They know how to get away with keep alive with very little, essentially, and being very frugal in some ways. We started this farm ourselves. We had, no one handed us a farm. We were a first generational farm. So big challenges, big hurdles to get over, financially, especially for capital investment. But everything that we've put into it has been growing. Our business has grown, around 100% each year. So we're expanding rapidly. We just won a couple business awards this year, a First Ontario Business Award, and a 40 Under 40 Business Award as well.
So, great. Good. Yeah. I assume you're affiliated with the Ontario Bee Association?
Yeah, we're members of the OBA. We go to the annual general meetings and are involved with them and make sure that we're up to date in everything that's happening in the bee world and make sure that we're, following the best practices as farmers.
Yeah. Right. Is the bee world growing, or is it stagnant, or is it declining? What's happening?
Absolutely. There's an interest in bees right now because I'm sure, if you're listening to this, you probably already know that there's a problem with the bees. It's been out in the news for a long time. It is not news anymore. There is still definitely a problem with our environment and pollinators. We're using systemic pesticides on a massive scale, and that's been linked directly to colony collapse. But out of this, people are getting interested. They want to start keeping bees, so we're seeing a huge increase in hobbyists. There is a major increase in interest.
Yeah. What does it take to start a bee colony?
Well, I don't know if we have time to get into all the details. I mean, we do offer like a course that goes into the introduction to beekeeping so people know what they're getting into. There is quite a bit. It is not just putting a beehive and letting them do their own thing. They require us to look after them. They're a domestic animal, so we really need to be making sure that we're keeping them healthy and happy. And that is your responsibility if you look after bees. So there's quite a few things that you need to do before you start, taking care of bees. And YouTube is an interesting place. I would not trust YouTube for all your answers. I would not trust just online sources. Go out to your local club. That's the best way to start. Talk to beekeepers.
Right.
Our main focus is actually breeding honeybees. So we breed them for specific genetic traits. and then we supply other farmers these honeybees and queen bees specifically. That's kind of our main thing. But yeah, education, equipment, we're kind of a one-stop shop in terms of beekeeping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.